Valdez versus State. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
Very well.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Christy Craig. I'm an attorney at the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I represented Mauricio Melendez in trial. He was charged with one count of murder in the first degree with use of a deadly weapon. We went to trial in July of 2009. On July 31st of 2009, he was convicted of first degree murder with use of a deadly weapon. In late September, he was sentenced to a 20 to life with a consecutive 8 to 20 for use of the weapon. He was accused and convicted of killing his wife, Chanel Melendez, on August 6, 2008 at just shy of midnight. The Melendezes were a married couple. They lived an ordinary life in a very small one-bedroom apartment in a not-so-great neighborhood in Las Vegas, not the worst neighborhood, but also not the best neighborhood in Las Vegas. They had one son who lived with them. He had the bedroom in that particular apartment. Chanel was a full-time waitress at a local restaurant. Mr. Melendez worked at Bally's in the cage. He was responsible for managing the money inside of Bally's. He was also a college student. He attended college at the University of Phoenix every Tuesday from 6 to 10 p.m. They were your ordinary hardworking couple on the lower side of the economic scale, but they tried real hard. He had no criminal record at all prior to August 6, 2008. Because they both worked, the only day that they had off together was a Wednesday, and August 6, 2008 was actually a Wednesday. They had spent the day together, spending time with their son, cleaning the house, all the sort of ordinary chores that a person would do. They were barbecuing, but they were also drinking, and they drank heavily that day. At the time of her death, Chanel Melendez's blood alcohol level was 0.16, which is twice the legal limit. We don't know what Mauricio's or Mao's blood level was because he delayed about 15 hours or so after her death before he called the police. But their son testified at trial that they had both been drinking most of the day. There wasn't any evidence presented of any arguments or fighting. There was no prior crimes of violence inside the home. There wasn't any that day. Their son testified that that night, after they returned from a run to the local 7-Eleven to get more beer, that his father was showing his mother, Chanel, the gun that they owned. Now, Mr. Melendez told the police that he, as a matter of routine, when they went to the local convenience store because of the neighborhood, he would fill the gun with 7 bullets. It was a revolver, and he would put it in his pocket, carry it with him to the store. And when he came home, it was his pattern to unload the gun, put it away, put the bullets back inside the closet. And that's what he believed happened that night, but he didn't have a clear memory because they'd been drinking a lot. The son testified that he saw them with the weapon at the kitchen table, and the father was showing it to the mother, and they were handling it. The son said that he heard a loud noise, and he went out into the kitchen area and saw his mother sitting there, and she had blood on her face and coming out of her ears, I believe. And Mr. Melendez lied to his son and said, "Well, just ketchup. It's juice. You know, go back to your room," because he didn't want his son to see his mother sitting there. He had also been drinking a great deal and just shooed his son back into the bedroom. Then he paced around. He moved his wife to the sofa. He covered her up in blankets. He wrapped her inside of a comforter. He wandered around the house and tried to get his senses back because he had been drinking so much. He also cleaned up the blood so that his son wouldn't see it the next day. Ultimately, the next day, after about 15 hours total from when she was shot, he did call the police. He didn't try to run, didn't try to hide the body. He certainly had enough time, if he had planned this, as the state alleged, to have escaped to Mexico if he chose to, but he didn't do any of those things. Prior, what we knew at the time that we went to trial was that really the only witness the state had that would be able to show premeditation and deliberation was a woman named Melissa Hill. Melissa Hill was a co-worker, sort of, of Mr. Melendez's. She worked in the cage at Paris, and Bally's and Paris share staff occasionally. They had worked together maybe five times. Ms. Hill testified that she and Mr. Melendez were working together. She asked him at the copy machine, "How you doing? How are things?" And he said, "I think I'm going to kill my wife." And that was it. She never told anybody. She didn't say anything. In fact, she waited almost 3 weeks after Chanel Melendez's death before she really told anybody. And in fact, there were plenty of witnesses who testified that she was an attention-seeking gossip hound who enjoyed the attention. And it was our position at trial, and what we shared with the jury during opening, is that she probably enjoyed the attention, told one or two people this sort of juicy tidbit that she probably made up, and then got caught up in her lie. She couldn't take it back because it steamrolled throughout the entire office, and then Human Resources encouraged her strongly to call the police, and by that time it was too late. At opening, we made quite a point of saying that the only witness that they were going to have was Melissa Hill, and she wasn't going to be a credible witness. We made quite a point of saying that there would be no evidence presented of any kind of premeditation, no kind of deliberate planning, that this was not a murder that was well planned out, that there was no evidence to suggest, no credible evidence to suggest that he had planned this ahead of time. We believed that Melissa Hill would be shown to be incredible, in fact. We went on at opening, because we had no knowledge of any other witnesses and no notice, saying that there would be no evidence of any motive. There would be no evidence that they had some sort of giant insurance policy and that he was going to collect a lot of money, or that they had a lot of jewels or property, or that either of them had boyfriends or girlfriends on the side, or that there was violence inside the home, that there wouldn't be any of that, which would have supported our theory at trial. What we later found out, and what became quite a problem, because we weren't aware of it until long after the opening was over and we had already made those promises, was that Chanel's sister, Claudine, would testify that her sister had told her that she was unhappy in her marriage and that she wanted to leave Mauricio Melendez but could not or would not because she was afraid that he would take her son and leave. We were unaware of this testimony. It was a shock and a surprise, and we objected to it at the time. Claudine testified, and the state sort of mushes these facts around to make it sound as if Claudine had talked to Chanel right a day or so before her death, and that in fact is not the case. Their last prior conversation was about 3 weeks before Chanel was killed, and Claudine testified that that conversation did not include any discussion of their relationship or her relationship problem.
There was no indication that Mr. Melendez had any indication or had any knowledge of that conversation.
No, there wasn't.
From what I've read. And I guess where I want to focus you a little bit is Ms. Hill.
Yes.
And you contend that you suffered a great deal of prejudice because you weren't allowed to impeach her to the degree that you thought was appropriate.
Well, that's true. We were not allowed to talk about some of the performance reports that the human resources person had. We were able to talk a little bit about her prior crimes because they were crimes of dishonesty.
And her other coworkers were also allowed to offer opinions as to her credibility as well, right?
They were, but we were limited. Part of the problem with Melissa Hill's testimony is that she got a lot of very important details wrong. She indicated that Mauricio had told her that he was going to kill his wife, and she described it as being her Friday. Well, her Friday was not a day that he actually worked. And so that was a very important fact to get out to the jury. We did ultimately get it out, but it was a bit of a battle to get out some of the descriptions of her as someone who exaggerates, someone who doesn't tell the truth, someone who could... she had attention-getting behavior as an explanation for why she had this very incredible story.
But her testimony essentially was everything that was there for premeditation as far as you're concerned.
Yes, and then the problem then is that when Claudine testified, suddenly what went from being incredible went to being essentially buttressed by Claudine's testimony, which we had no knowledge of or no awareness of, that she was actually unhappy in her marriage and that she wanted to leave him. And that just made what was previously incredible more credible, and that would be Melissa Hill's testimony, which was something that we were unaware of, and it was quite a problem, I think, given what we had promised during opening. And I think I'm going to...
Counsel, other than being restricted on your ability to cross-examine concerning the witness's employment history, was there any other area that you wanted to cross-examine that the judge refused?
As I recall, we wanted to go more in depth into the problems she had with human resources revolving this actual incident, because it was quite a long, drawn-out process from when she first told somebody on August the 18th, 3 weeks after the murder, to when she was essentially forced to file a report. There was some language in some of the documents where it appeared that she thought she was in trouble and that she was having problems from the people above her and essentially being forced in to make a report. And I don't think we were able to get into that enough. May I reserve the last 4 minutes?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Ms. Renetti, on behalf of the state.
Thank you. Please, the court. My name is Dina Renetti. I'm a deputy district attorney, and I was one of the trial counsels for this particular case. I just wanted to briefly mention a couple of facts because there's a big issue as far as premeditation and deliberation regarding this murder. This indeed, in fact, happened at the Mauricio Melendez's apartment where he shared with his wife as well as their young son. On that evening when they got back from the convenience store at the 7-Eleven, their son went to bed, and within about an hour of them returning home from the 7-Eleven, he heard a shot. He came out, the defendant was calm, cool, collected, and told his son, "Don't worry, mommy just has ketchup in their ear," and there was a rag on top of mom's head, and the defendant indicated that it was just juice on top of her head. Kieran went back to the bedroom, and in fact, there's some conflicting testimony within Kieran's testimony at trial that whether or not his father actually locked him into the bedroom. But Kieran, it was explicitly clear that he was not able to leave the bedroom that night. During the 15 hours that Mauricio Melendez was in that apartment with his dead wife, he made some interesting movements. Not only did he remove Mrs. Melendez and brought her to the couch, but he actually meticulously wrapped her body in several towels, and then with a comforter. During that time frame, he also took the revolver that was used during this murder and hid it in the closet. It was underneath a tool, a big electric drill, in fact. During this time frame, he also took pictures of his dead wife, one at 3:26 in the morning. He uncovered her, and you can see that her face is framed by those towels and the comforter. And in fact, at 7:16 in the morning, he takes four more pictures. It's not until 15 hours after her death that 911 is called. And what is particularly interesting as far as what evidence of premeditation did the state present, it was not just Melissa Hill's testimony, which was important, but there was other evidence of premeditation and deliberation. The state presented evidence that prior to this murder, that the defendant was on the internet at the home computer. We were able to eliminate that it was in fact him on the computer because the computer was accessed on that particular day while Mrs. Melendez was at work and Kieran was at school. During that computer session, the defendant actually was looking up weapons, in particular firearms, guns, how to use them and how to shoot them. Those were particularly of interest to the state as far as proving premeditation and deliberation when in conjunction with his statements to Melissa Hill just shortly before the murder. As far as the appellant's issues regarding Claudine Eggleston was in fact the victim's sister. She was noticed as a witness, so the defense was on notice that we did in fact intended to call her. and that she was an important witness in the fact that there was some issues regarding the marriage. That this, they were an ordinary, hardworking couple, but they also had some issues in their relationship. But Claudine Eggleston, her address, were all in the notice of witnesses that was provided and filed with the court. As far as Melissa Hill's testimony, it was important to the state as far as premeditation and deliberation. However, the defense was able to go into at length Ms. Hill's criminal history regarding her crimes of dishonesty, and in fact, they were able to call witnesses, some of Melissa Hill's co-workers, to talk about Melissa Hill. However, the trial court did rule that Melissa Hill's employment records as far as being late to work were really irrelevant. And the state stands by the trial court's ruling on that.
Is that all that they sought to get in? Was it the fact that her employment records show she was late for work?
That, as well as there was a policy at the Valleys that they were not allowed to speak about the case, and that she did was, in fact, was speaking about the case. That's why she had told a coworker, oh, guess what, I think I heard Mauricio tell me that he was going to kill his wife. And that violated Valley's policy as far as whether or not they were allowed to talk about the case. Those were the areas that they were trying to get into. Whether or not she was late to work really is of no relevance to her truthfulness. But what is interesting is that despite the trial court's ruling, defense counsel did, in fact, ask the question. The state objected. It's now the bell has been rung. There's no way to take it back. I believe the trial court struck the question, but now it's out there, despite the fact that the trial court had ruled it was irrelevant as far as impeachment purposes, whether or not she was late to work. It really had no bearing. The defense was able to get into her criminal history, as well as prevent several witnesses, her co-workers, to talk about Melissa Hill. They had an adequate opportunity to discredit Ms. Hill, and the jury verdict said otherwise. As far as premeditation and deliberation, it was abundantly clear that this was the appropriate verdict in this case. This was two individuals that were experiencing problems in their marriage. Mauricio had had enough. He couldn't flee to Mexico. They came out in opening statements that he was a loving father, loved Kieran very much, and the theory is that he did not want to lose Kieran and wouldn't move to Mexico and leave Kieran here in the United States. The internet access shortly before the murder, the defendant looking up gun websites, various gun websites just prior to the murder, as well as his statements to Melissa Hill, all contributed to the jury's verdict of first-degree murder. And then there was also the evidence itself that evening. That evening, the defense put forward a theory that it was an accidental shooting, that the defendant was just showing Mrs. Melendez how to use the gun. And what was brought out in the state's case in chief is, in fact, that Mrs. Melendez suffered one gunshot wound about 4 inches from the top of her head. It was in close range, between 1 and 18 inches away from her head. It was not a contact wound. We did have to rule out a suicide in this case because the defendant made a 911 call, and there the dispatcher asked on the 911 call, well, what happened? And the defendant indicated that he didn't know what happened. He didn't do anything, and his son didn't do anything, leaving the inference that this was, in fact, a suicide. But this wasn't a suicide, and the defendant's various statements to police as well as dispatch proved that. During the 911 call, the defendant was elusive, didn't really know what had happened. When interviewed by homicide detectives, he indicated that he didn't know what happened at first. And eventually he said, well, okay, I was trying to teach her how to use the gun, and it went off. When asked to explain how, in fact, this happened, He was unable to provide any details as to exactly how he showed the wife, how to use the gun, how he pointed the wife, the gun at his wife, and why, in fact, he would point the firearm at his wife's head in order to show her how to use the firearm. Are there any other questions from the court?
The appellant suggests that in your closing argument, you somehow vouched for the credibility of Ms. Hill by actually using her employment and suggesting that because she worked in a casino where she was entrusted with cash, that she was likely to be a more credible witness than not. Can you address that issue?
Of course. I would be happy to. The actual words that the deputy used was, "Casinos trust her, she can't be that dishonest." Granted, we were unable to, under case law, I think it's abundantly clear under Valdez, that we're not allowed to ask questions about whether or not that a witness has an opinion on whether or not another witness has lied or was untruthful. However, I think Ms. Hill's employment is fair common as far as a rebuttal argument in order to say, you know, look, casinos trust her. She's allowed to handle money. It's for you to draw your own conclusions, but I think it is fair comment. I don't think it's vouching for her. It was just merely arguing the evidence that was before the jury that, in fact, she was working at a casino. And she was working at a casino before the comment was made to her by Mr. Melendez, and she continued to work for the casinos even after Mr. Melendez and Mrs. Melendez was murdered.
You would suggest then that it wasn't prosecutorial misconduct, and therefore we don't even get to the second prong of that analysis, whether the conduct itself would warrant reversal.
That is correct.
Colleagues? Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time.
Ms. Crick, and rebuttal.
First, with regard to the evidence of premeditation, what she's listed for you is really two things: Melissa Hill and the fact that he looked on the computer at weapons. Mr. Melendez had a licensed firearm. He was a gun owner. I hardly think that looking at guns online means that you're going to go out and kill someone. I mean, that's not a reasonable assumption to make, no matter how close in time it was to the murder. He owned his firearm legally. It was registered. He had the blue card out when the police got there. Looking at guns and how to clean them and how to use them is certainly not sufficient evidence of premeditation. The evidence of premeditation in this case was Melissa Hill's incredible testimony, buttressed by Claudine's inappropriate testimony. Additionally, their son testified that he saw his mother and his father handling that gun just before he went to bed. These were two intoxicated people touching and handling a gun, and he was showing it to her. They weren't fighting. He wasn't pointing it at her. They were simply examining the gun together, which is a terrible thing, I think, for two people who've been drinking to be doing, and I think what happened in this case is exactly why that shouldn't happen. She also pointed out that the gun was fired from 1 inch to 18 inches away. I think it's important to note that they were sitting very close together, and that establishes exactly what we had been talking about and what's supported by the testimony of the son. Finally, with regard to the state vouching for Melissa Hill, during the trial, they also brought out several times that she had gotten a sheriff's card, that she'd been vetted by the sheriff, that they had looked at her prior to her employment, and then she had to get another sheriff's card again, talking about the investigation that you have to go through. That was another point that we were not particularly happy with, and we don't think it was appropriate for the state to have done that. It adds an additional indicia of reliability to Melissa Hill's testimony, as if the state has signed off in some way, not just the state, but the sheriff as well. That makes her somehow more believable, especially in a case like this where she is the evidence of premeditation. And then finally, I'd just like to touch just a bit on the testimony from Detective Pop. That was actually another problem that caused us great concern at trial. Detective Pop testified that he thought that the scene had been staged by Mr. Melendez after the murder. And he started to testify, and actually did testify, that he discovered Mr. Melendez's driver's license as well as his gun registration card. And he thought that was odd and strange and that he had only seen that kind of thing in cases of suicide, implying that this may have been a murder-suicide gone awry, and that our defendant, Mr. Melendez, chickened out when he got to his part. That was disturbing. We had no notice of it. He testified essentially as an expert, because he said it was in his expert opinion, based on years of police work, that that's how it appeared to him. He did not testify that way at the preliminary hearing. There was no suggestion of that in any of the police reports that we had received, that there was this idea that could potentially be a suicide gone wrong. If we had known that, we certainly would have hired experts to talk about what that scene looked like and what really happens at murder-suicides. We would have been able to confront that. We were not able to do that in this case because we had no knowledge of it prior to the detective.
Why didn't you object to that testimony a little bit earlier?
Well, Detective Pop testified over a two-day period.
Right.
At the moment he said it, I think we sort of sat there and wondered, did I actually hear that? But we did object as soon as we started up the next day, and Detective Pop was still on direct examination. We made a lengthy record about the fact that we didn't have any notice. We were objecting to the testimony, and that it was, you know, we felt like we were being ambushed.
No, please finish your thought.
That was the end.
Other questions, colleagues? Thank you, Ms. Craig, Ms. Renetti. Thank you very much. This case will be submitted. The court will be in recess.